From the studios of WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. This January, a jury convicted a Wilmington man of two counts of transporting young women across state lines with the intent to force them into prostitution. Last September, a different Wilmington man was sentenced to more than 11 years behind bars for the sex trafficking of minors. Two men were arrested last August for kidnapping underage girls and forcing them to work. Human trafficking is alive and well in southeastern North Carolina, but it's a difficult crime to prosecute because so many victims remain in the shadows. It's the victims, often young women, who historically have faced prosecution. But the tide is turning, thanks in part to the passage in 2013 of the Safe Harbor Act for victims of sex trafficking. Former State Senator Tom Goolsbee was a primary sponsor of that bill. On today's edition of Coastline, we'll find out why southeastern North Carolina has become a favorite spot for traffickers and how law enforcement is shifting its approach to the problem. We'll also learn why this is not just an issue for people brought here from other countries, but why Americans, and particularly children, are vulnerable. To help us explore these issues, we have the supervisor of the Rape Crisis Center at Coastal Horizons joining us. Jessica Green is also a member of the Cape Fear Human Trafficking Rapid Response Team. Jessica Green, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us today, he's a detective in the New Hanover County Sheriff's Department who specializes in going after traffickers. Detective Will Campbell, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
When we're talking about human trafficking, so often we're talking about forced prostitution, but what other kinds of forced servitude does human trafficking include, and what are you seeing here in the Cape Fear region, Detective Campbell?
It encompasses a lot of things. It can be sex trafficking, labor trafficking, like you said, forced prostitution. Human trafficking is a lot of things. There's a big difference between human trafficking and human smuggling, which a lot of people don't understand. It's not a lot of people refer to the movie Taken with Liam Neeson. It's certainly not the case most of the time.
And just to be clear, what is the difference between trafficking and smuggling?
Smuggling really is bringing bodies into the country, forcing them. You think of the people in Connex trailers being forced in, and then human trafficking, sex trafficking is forcing people into servitude, you know, for sex or labor or things like that.
And who tend to be the victims of these kinds of crimes in this area? Are we talking about mostly Americans? Are we talking about people from other countries? Is it a pretty equal mix?
Just in my experience in doing this the past few years, they've all been Americans, and they've typically all really been from this region. And it's spanned from, you know, as young as 14 to 15 up in, you know, to young adults, even into their 30s.
And Jessica Green from the Rape Crisis Center, you've said that so many of these victims get into prostitution between the ages of 12 and 14. How does that happen?
Well, I think when we look at what the baseline risk factors for getting introduced in this sort of lifestyle, they're pretty typical of a lot of teenagers. So we're talking about, you know, under the age of 18, desire to feel wanted and loved, have low self-esteem. They walk to anywhere by themselves, whether it's to the school or to store or anything like that. And then they also desire consumer goods. And when we kind of go down that list, it's like, wow, that kind of fits every single teenager that I know.
It sure does.
And that can create an environment where these sorts of perpetrators of these crimes take advantage of that.
What makes one child more vulnerable in a circumstance than another? Because we all know there's teenage angst that, as you said, every single teenager goes through that. Every single teenager has things that they want that possibly they can't get. Every single teenager feels misunderstood by their parents and possibly the rest of their family. Why is one child vulnerable and another isn't?
I would say that the biggest factor is support. Do they have support at home? Do they have support in their school? Do they have support in their community? And that's why when we talk about prevention of this type of crime, that mentorship programs are so important, because even if they aren't getting that support at home, we hope that they're getting it somewhere. And if they're not, then they're more likely to engage in these sorts of behaviors and really become attracted to these sorts of lifestyles where people are telling them, you know, you're loved, you're special. And then they take that kind of psychological hold and ask them to do things that most children wouldn't consider doing.
And so there's a bond that's created, Detective Campbell, between the perpetrator and the child first, before the perpetrator starts forcing that child into.
Absolutely. Every time that, in every case I've seen, that's exactly how it's been. There's been some sort of a relationship formed, whether it be boyfriend, girlfriend kind of thing, and then slowly you see it turning to where they're forcing them into doing what they want them to.
Why is this so hard to investigate and prosecute, Detective Campbell?
It's very similar. When you think about these human trafficking cases and you talk to other cops and the cases they hate to work, whether it be typically it's domestic violence style cases or sexual assaults, rapes, things like that, they're the hardest to investigate. The victims are very rarely overly cooperative, and a lot of the people that we've come in contact with have had negative experience with law enforcement in the past, so they're reluctant to want to work with us anyway.
And you're talking about the victims who've had negative experiences with law enforcement.
Yes, ma'am.
How has this shift in law enforcement's approach happened recently since the 2013 passage of the Safe Harbor Act? What's different?
Well, within the past 2 years, our sheriff and the chief of police have mandated in-service training for all deputies and officers in Wilmington and throughout the county. That's school resource officers, patrol officers. Everyone who has a badge and a gun has to go to this in-service training. And human trafficking in 2013 and 2013 for the city and for us in 2014 was mandated that you had to attend this training. And since then, I mean, it just wrapped up at the end of last year. The amount of phone calls that we get now just from our deputies on the street, things that they see now and they think, well, maybe this is what we were taught. And it's much different than it was in the past.
And what's different about what they're taught? What are they seeing on the street now that they might not have recognized in the past?
I mean, they're seeing the same things that they always have, but before they didn't know to look for it.
Such as?
My partner made a good point earlier that if you do a traffic stop on somebody and you're a drug dealer or whatnot and you have narcotics in the car, you get caught with the narcotics, a dog or something can smell the narcotics, then you're caught. But you get pulled over with a female in the car who doesn't speak, it looks like a boyfriend and girlfriend just got pulled over and the cop moves on. But now if the cop's picking up on these indicators where she looks overly nervous or there's a ton of hotel key cards in the floorboard or, all their luggage or clothes are strewn across the back of the car, they're starting to see these things now and starting to try to ask, separate them and start asking questions to figure out what's going on.
Jessica Green, how has the language changed that we use when we talk about this issue of human trafficking? I heard you say when you were talking with our producer that survivors are being arrested at a disproportionately higher rate. We don't often hear the term survivor when mm-hmm. we're talking about it.
And I think that the language that we use, while it seems like such a simple thing and, sometimes people will be like, oh, well, we're just being PC, language is very powerful. And the language that we use when we're talking about victims versus survivors or even prostitution versus commercial sexual exploitation of children, just for example, let's look at the term teen prostitute. When you ask people to describe what they think of when they see that, they're seeing girls walking down the street in high heels and fishnets and that they're criminals, that they're easy, those sorts of things. But when I say the term commercial sexual exploitation of children, we see them instead as the victims of these crimes, as survivors of these crimes. And I think that that has a lot to do with how we treat them and getting them into services so that this isn't a cycle that they continue to engage in, that they're able to get hooked into the different organizations that they need to in order to go on to be successful.
You are part of the Cape Fear Human Trafficking Rapid Response Team, Jessica Green. So when, say, a car is pulled over and an officer suspects that there is a victim in the car of human trafficking, what happens next?
Well, we have many members who are in our community who are on the team, Will Campbell being one of them. And so we've really created a multidisciplinary approach to addressing this sort of crime so that within the first hours of identification of these victims, that they're getting hooked into safe shelter, that they're getting provided with resources that they need. And a lot of times that first priority is where can we make sure that this person is going to be safe and that may or may not be in this community. So we may have to look at utilizing some of our statewide and federal partners on the Cape Fear Human Trafficking Rapid Response Team to utilize their resources to get this person somewhere where they're going to be safe, because that's the number one priority.
And why? What happens when a victim is reluctant to work with law enforcement? Is that something that you at the Rape Crisis Center or the Rapid Response Team can have some sort of impact on?
Absolutely. Our job, particularly as victim advocates, is to simply inform them of all of their options, because just like a lot of us watch crime shows, so does the general public. And so there's a lot of confusion about what that process is going to look like. And so when you have someone who's there that's able to explain realistically this is what's going to happen, that they're actually more likely to report, that they're more likely to engage, and when they don't feel pressured in any way, they're able to think a little bit more clearly. And that's something that's been really successful for us, not just in sex trafficking, but also in sexual violence in general. And it's been really helpful for our community, I think, for people to realize that they do have options and that they have choices. And we never try to force anyone into one thing or another, because we can't guarantee their safety, and we have to recognize that especially adult survivors, they're the experts in their lives. And so they know what's going to be best for them. And we just have to support them. And then when they do finally decide to leave that dangerous situation, we're their first phone call. And we've already got things in place. We've already been talking with Will, so he's aware of what's going on. So it can be a really seamless process.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking with Jessica Green of the Rape Crisis Center and Detective Will Campbell from the New Hanover County Sheriff's Department about human trafficking in our region, why it's so difficult to bring out of the shadows and address. If you have a question for our guests, we're opening up the phone lines. Give us a call, 910-343-1138. You can also send an email to coastline@whqr.org or tweet us at @CoastlineHQR. This is Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're talking about human trafficking in the Cape Fear region, why it's hard to get a handle on, how our handling of it in the judicial system is changing, and what role the public can play in helping law enforcement. With us in the studio today, Detective Will Campbell of the New Hanover County Sheriff's Department and Jessica Green of the Rape Crisis Center. You're invited to join the discussion. Do you have a question or a comment for our guests? Give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org or tweet us at @CoastlineHQR. Detective Campbell, there was an article in Police Chief Magazine that says there are some departments around the country in which officers scoff at the notion that human trafficking is an issue in their jurisdictions. And that means that those working to fight it, like you, often do so in relative isolation. Is it recognized here as a serious problem?
Oh, I definitely think so. Like I said earlier, with our mandated in-service training, it's opened a lot of people's eyes. And I don't think that's really a major issue here in Wilmington.
Jessica Green, how do you see that issue when you're just out and about in the community? Do you think it's widely recognized by the public as an issue?
I think that we're definitely moving in that direction. I feel like when I go to speaking engagements that I'm more often than not asked about human trafficking versus rape and sexual assault, which is really wonderful that people are starting to recognize that this is indeed an issue and that it happens here, because sometimes that's what's the surprising factor, that it's not all foreign-born victims, that it's not something that's happening somewhere else far away that we don't have to be concerned about or have the kind of, oh, those poor people attitude about it, but that it is indeed happening in our own community. And that sort of awareness is so important to actually being able to address and prevent the problem.
And how is it happening here more than, say, other communities that are comparable to ours? Why is the Cape Fear region prone to this kind of problem?
Well, I think that it is surprising to people to know that North Carolina is in the top 10 states for human trafficking. And a lot of that has to do with the major highways, the fact that Wilmington in general is a destination location, that we have a port, and that North Carolina has a few large military bases, which typically when you go to a town with a military base, it's surrounded by establishments that are categorized as adult entertainment, and those unfortunately can be places where we find child exploitation happening.
And I think one of the issues around this that is hard for people to understand, if you're an American-born person, why would someone feel trapped? Why would they feel that they couldn't just call 911 and say, hey, I'm in a situation, or run and knock on a door? What stops them from doing that?
Well, a lot of that is the psychological hold that the perpetrator has established. They have done meticulous work to make sure that that victim feels completely isolated, that if they come forward, that no one is going to believe them or want to help them. And there is still a very large stigma surrounded by rape and sexual assault, so that people feel like if they come forward, that they're not going to be supported and that they're not going to be believed and that no one's going to want to help them. And so we try to do as much education as possible to inform our community that that's not, in fact, the case. And, you know, these perpetrators use substance abuse. They use financial means. They use all sorts of tactics that provide them to have as much control as possible of another human being.
And when you say substance abuse, you're talking about the perpetrator giving the victim drugs to keep them hooked.
Absolutely.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about human trafficking in southeastern North Carolina, why it's tough to prosecute, and how our treatment of survivors and perpetrators is evolving. With us to answer your questions are Jessica Green of Coastal Horizons Rape Crisis Center and Detective Will Campbell of the New Hanover County Sheriff's Department. If you have a question for our guests, give us a call at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. You can also tweet us using CoastlineHQR. And I see we have a correction here. Detective Campbell works for the sheriff's office, not the sheriff's department. Apologies about that.
Ma'am.
And we will say that properly from here on out. In 2011, the National Association of Attorneys General, which included North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper, sent a letter to a popular website. It's similar to Craigslist, where all kinds of services are advertised on this website, including adult services. And the letter detailed the way some of these ads for adult services contribute to human trafficking and the victimization of minors. And we contacted the Attorney General's office to find out whether there was any response from this website. The letter demanded a response by a certain time. You know, what are you doing to help us with this and combat this? And we haven't heard yet. They're looking into it, and we do expect an update on that later today. But Detective Campbell, what are you seeing with this particular website where so many of these victims are offered to the public? What's your relationship with that website?
The website and the things that it advertises are bad. And I totally agree with that. A lot of people think, you know, prostitution and pretty woman and women walking the street corners. It's just not really the case anymore. It's digital now. There's an online marketplace for it. And this, among many other websites, is where they go. You know, there's been a lot of call for this website to be shut down. And I agree that websites like this should be shut down, but they're going to open up elsewhere. And let's say if this one shuts down and it moves overseas, you know, to a totally different continent, and then what jurisdiction or anything, what reign do we have over them to try to make them cooperate with us? Right now, the website that you're talking about is extremely cooperative. And, you know, I'd hate to see it move from that to where we're losing investigative tools because, you know, this entity has moved somewhere where they don't have to cooperate with us.
So in a way, the presence of these ads on this particular website actually helps law enforcement. It gives you a pathway to some of the perpetrators.
Absolutely.
How does that work? How does the website cooperate?
Without getting into it, you know, as far as how we work our cases and investigative styles, if we, you know, request information from the website, then they, with a court order, they will provide it back to us.
We have a caller, Amber from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air. Hello.
Hi,
Amber.
This is Amber. I'm from Wilmington, and I was calling to see if there are any resources helping these victims in the area.
Jessica Green from the Rape Crisis Center.
Yes, there are actually many organizations that are out there helping. I can to give a selfless shame plug, the Rape Crisis Center of Coastal Horizons. We've been doing this sort of work in the community for 35 years. We also have the Domestic Violence Shelter in town and multiple other shelter organizations, including A Safe Place and Good Shepherd. And then, of course, our wonderful partners in law enforcement are helping us with this issue significantly.
Does that answer your question, Amber?
Yes, thank you very much.
All right, thanks so much for your call. What does this kind of experience, when someone is rescued from a situation, a sex trafficking situation, a survivor, what does that do to a child, especially if she was first victimized when she was very young, say, you know, 12 to 14, that window when you talk about they become, that's the point when they become vulnerable to this. What issues is she likely to face?
Oh, goodness. A whole slew of issues, primarily being a distortion of what a healthy relationship looks like. And I was actually talking with someone about this earlier because these people are brought up in a world where everything comes at a price. And so, you know, people always want to know a survivor's story, or they want me to see if I can't find a survivor who will speak. And I'm really hesitant to do that simply because as a service provider, we have an obligation to inform these people that you don't owe us anything, that you have a right to services, that you have a right to be a normal person, and that I'm not going to turn around and then want to exploit your experience to get, you know, some sort of recognition for my own organization. And so in addition to the self-esteem and kind of having to rewire their brains to realize that healthy relationships include respect, that it includes a mutual love, that it includes an equal power balance. And unfortunately, if children are not hooked into the appropriate services, if they're not receiving therapy and are able to kind of rework the way that they think, they will stay in that cycle for the rest of their lives, thinking that that's what's normal because that's normal to them.
And what can the Rape Crisis Center do to help combat that?
Well, we are really fortunate that we have several very talented clinicians on staff that are able to provide therapy at no cost to survivors. And so they're especially trained in these type of issues that are surrounding sexual trauma. And so they work with them for as however long that it takes. We've got advocates on staff who are helping them get into GED programs, that are helping them get into substance abuse treatment programs, that are helping them, you know, address the financial issues so that they can be independent and not have to rely on a lifestyle that's been providing for them their entire lives. So we work really hard to make sure that people kind of holistically are being provided with services.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about human trafficking in southeastern North Carolina, why it's tough to prosecute, and how our treatment of survivors and perpetrators is evolving. With us to answer your questions are Jessica Green of Coastal Horizons Rape Crisis Center and Detective Will Campbell of the New Hanover County Sheriff's Office. If you have a question, give us a call, 910-343-1138, or email us at coastline@whqr.org. You can also tweet us at @CoastlineHQR. We have an email from Isabel, not our producer. And the question is Congress aware of the effort? If so, which members can we contact?
That is a question that's really difficult to answer. I know that there's a bill being passed through legislation right now, the National, I think, Modern Slavery to End Modern Slavery that's going on. Who specifically is on that bill, I'm not entirely sure. It's also important to note that that bill is getting investments from other foreign agencies and things like that. And it's actually going to go to fund organizations outside of the U.S.
Right.
So it won't necessarily affect us here at home, except for that hopefully we will see a decrease in people being trafficked internationally to our state.
You're referring to the End Modern Slavery Initiative.
That's
and I think it's a bipartisan bill that is working its way. I think it just passed a Senate committee. But yeah, we can get more information on that, certainly. You're listening to Coastline. If you have a question for our guests about human trafficking, give us a call at 910-343-1138. Detective Campbell, do you ever work with or get assistance from federal agencies on local cases or initiatives?
Yes, ma'am. Like you said earlier with the rapid response team, it's made up of local, state, federal agencies. And, you know, just as recent as, you know, in recent cases, we contact the DA's office. Here locally, we contact the U.S. Attorney's Office. We have everybody on board, kind of an all-hands-on-deck approach from the very beginning, you know, with victim services and all members of the response team.
This must be very tough work to do for both of you? I mean, you know, you're Detective Campbell, you're coming at it from the very beginning of a case when you're first encountering a victim, and Jessica Green from the Rape Crisis Center, you're then immediately getting involved with the victim to render services and help this person get into a better situation. But how do you deal with this in your personal life? How do you dissociate from what must be some horror, really?
Do you want to start?
I mean, I think it's something, it's not really just this kind of work. It's all, you know, law enforcement, EMS, doctors, firefighters. It's stuff that all of us see. And at some point, you either, you know, get numb to it, you compartmentalize it, and you move on. It's what you sign up for, and you know, you deal with it. And, you know, helping the next person helps you deal with what you dealt with, you know, prior to that.
So actually, with each case that goes along, it gives you a good reason to keep going forward. Is
Absolutely.
That what you're saying?
Yeah.
Jessica Green?
Well, it's really funny because I feel like any time in which I tell somebody who doesn't know me what I do for a living, their first response is, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. It's like, well, I wanted this job. I actually applied for it. I'm very happy to be doing this. And a lot of it has to do with kind of the attitude and kind of your perspective when you go into work every single day, because I know that sexual violence happens. I know that it's happening every single day in our own community. However, if a victim is getting hooked into our services, then I know that we are educating them, we're providing them with options that otherwise that they wouldn't have had that experience. They wouldn't have had those to be able to make an educated decision and have the support that they really need. So, and then we, of course, have wonderful partners that make our job so much easier. And I think that I work with the best group of people on the face of the planet. So I'm happy to go to work every day.
Detective Campbell, how did you get into specifically investigating sex trafficking cases?
It's funny. I started out with the sheriff's office. I first worked in the jail. Then I worked on patrol for a little while, and then came up with the detectives. And I was actually a juvenile investigator where I focused on defendants and suspects that are under the age of 18, 16, things like that. And we had a case come about where the Wilmington Police Department, one of their domestic violence detectives, was working it, and they needed assistance in the county. And nobody had really worked a human trafficking case before. And they called me and said, look, this is what we've got. And at that point, we didn't even know really it was a human trafficking case. We didn't know what it was going to turn out to be. And you actually spoke earlier about a conviction, and that's actually it.
Are you talking the one in August?
The one where the guy was sentenced in January of this year.
Right, right. Okay, the most recent.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. What are some of the tactics that the sheriff's office uses to prosecute these cases?
As far as prosecution, and I don't really know how to get into that. You know, what I really can harp on is the in-service training that all the officers are seeing now, because these cases, sex trafficking, labor trafficking, whatever, they don't present themselves as, hey, I'm a human trafficking case. It comes about as a domestic violence case, or, you know, a traffic stop where an officer notices something that's a little, you know, out of left field. And, you know, even other cases, they come about as counterfeit money cases, and then the people involved, you start to realize that there's something else there. So really the biggest part is training for law enforcement and all the troops that are out on the ground knowing what they're looking at or having some sort of idea that something's not quite right.
And just to be clear, you're also a little reluctant to talk about some of the tactics because you just don't want those to become known.
Surely.
So that they're still usable.
Right, right.
Which makes complete sense. You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Detective Will Campbell of the New Hanover County Sheriff's Office and Jessica Green of Coastal Horizons Rape Crisis Center about human trafficking in southeastern North Carolina. If you have a question, give us a call at 910-343-1138 or send us an email at coastline@whqr.org. One of the things that we've talked about is how the law has changed to help victims and survivors of these crimes. And we've talked about how children are now seen as victims, regardless of their, well, there is no culpability. Is that right, Jessica Green, when it comes to a child, no matter what they've done, someone under 18?
Right, exactly, which is a huge shift. And I think that it's really important that we are now recognizing that they are victims. We can get them hooked into the services that they need to so that those aren't behaviors that they're engaging in time and time again.
In the past, somebody who was 16 or 17 could be convicted of sex of prostitution?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
And now they cannot be convicted.
Exactly, which is a huge, huge win for us.
What else has changed from a legal standpoint in terms of how we deal with these crimes? What about adults? Have things shifted for, say, an adult woman? She's over 18, but she's still part of sexual trafficking.
Right. So if an adult woman now is charged with prostitution and it's the first charge of prostitution, then she'll be referred to deferred prosecution no matter what. And if it's a subsequent charge, then it's the district attorney's office. They can, it's their discretion whether or not they want to refer her to deferred prosecution. And even convictions before October 2013, if it was a conviction where they were exploited, it was a conviction based on them being exploited, then they can be referred to deferred prosecution as well.
And then if someone also is convicted of prostitution, prosecuted for prostitution, there is a possibility for that record to be expunged?
Yes, ma'am. Now they can go and apply for expungement.
Jessica.
And additionally, if it is an adult, if we are able to prove in some way that there was force, fraud, or coercion involved, that would consider them to be a victim of human trafficking and not just, and I hate just saying just a prostitute, but that's typically how they've been seen in the past. So that if we are able to meet any of those elements, that they're able to realize, oh, this person is a victim of this crime.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking about human trafficking in southeastern North Carolina, why it's a problem, and how the approach to enforcement and treatment of survivors is changing. Jessica Green of the Rape Crisis Center and Detective Will Campbell of the New Hanover County Sheriff's Office are here to answer your questions. You can ask a question by calling 910-343-1138. And when we come back, we'll take a call. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and with me in the studio once again, Detective Will Campbell of the New Hanover County Sheriff's Office and Jessica Green of Coastal Horizons Rape Crisis Center. If you have a question or a comment for any of our guests, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can send an email to coastline@whqr.org or tweet us at @CoastlineHQR. Don from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I suspect a lot of the people that you're talking about are caught up in human trafficking, the victims. They're reluctant to be helped. They feel, I believe, like they're in a situation where they're going to be somehow punished for what they're doing. And if you look at how they got there, I mean, at some point they were probably trying to be helped to not get into the situation that landed them in that spot. I mean, by their family, their friends. I mean, that's a long chain of, circumstances and events that led them to this position.
That's a great point, Don, and that's something, Jessica Green, we've been seeing a shift in how we're treating victims. Are we seeing a shift in how victims view those people who are trying to help them?
Yes, that is something that we work really hard to work towards, and that's why we do the multidisciplinary collaborative approach to it, because these victims are taught not to trust systems. Maybe they have attempted to reach out before and that's been unsuccessful for them, or people didn't know how to help them, had not been educated and trained on how to help them effectively. And so, we really try to approach it from a way of, this is your experience. You are telling us what you need. We will inform you of your options. There's no pressure. And hopefully that's something that they respond to and that they know that when they do, again, decide to leave that dangerous situation, that they are going to get the help that they need and that they're not going to be punished in any way.
And that is an educational process in terms of getting that message out to the public, isn't it, Jessica Green?
Absolutely.
Don, well, thanks.
My mind is going in the direction of they have to help themselves, but they can't. But the people that are most like themselves are other people that have been victims of this, just like alcoholics, join Alcoholics Anonymous, drug users, they're they connect with other drug users better than anybody else. So what about that going in that direction?
How do they get out of the fishbowl? Is that what you mean, Don?
Well, like, you know, how do they connect up with other people that are like themselves, you know?
Oh, you mean how do they connect with other victims that...
Get help from other victims like themselves, you know, because I bet those people have the most experience with dealing, you know, with getting out of the situation and dealing with the aftermath. They know what it means.
Jessica Green?
Yeah, absolutely. And you are completely right. And sometimes having other survivors talk about their experiences can be something that's really helpful. And so we let people know, you do not have to commit to anything. You don't have to commit to filing a report or anything like that. But you can still get services, which include survivors groups where they can come and talk with other survivors about their experience. And some of those may, in fact, be survivors of human trafficking. And then that way they are able to kind of learn from each other. And because what we don't want to do is we don't want to tell community members, oh, go out and search out victims of human trafficking and spread the word to them, because that can actually be very dangerous mm-hmm. and very counterintuitive. So we have to create an environment where survivors can come forward. And a lot of that has to do with, survivors supporting one another.
Thanks so much for your call, Don. What are some of the indicators that suggest there could be a human trafficking situation? And I'm talking about not from a law enforcement perspective, Detective Campbell, but what would you tell members of the public to look out for?
Some of the red flags, I guess, we start from the beginning, kind of like what Jessica said earlier. These girls that are very vulnerable, that have experienced sexual abuse early on in life, they come from... not always single-parent homes, but a lot of single-parent homes or parents that are in prison, things like that. One of the biggest things that we at the Sheriff's Office are seeing now, not so much just with sex trafficking, human trafficking, but with pretty much every, you know, the criminal aspect we're dealing with now is social media and the Internet.
How is that helping traffickers?
Well, in pretty much every case that I've worked, the traffickers have reached out through social media and just send out mass messages through various social media outlets, trying to recruit young girls that are vulnerable. And they send out a very specific message to all of them. You know, I see the same message sent to 30 or 40 girls a day that, you know, who do you live with? How's school? Are your parents at home? Do you play sports? You know, they don't want somebody who's, you know, a honor roll that is, you know, star athlete, and, you know, they want the one who's sitting at home by themselves at, you know, 5:30 in the afternoon and nobody's there.
So who does this girl think is messaging her?
A potential boyfriend, a friend, something like that. Somebody's reaching out to her, showing her the attention that nobody else is showing her right now, and that's how it starts. You know, he'll provide, you know, the attention that she's longing for, and then soon enough, you know, that's all she has, and she has nowhere to run after she's already with him, because that's what she knows.
So is it enough to teach our girls not to talk to older men? Or do they sometimes bond with the potential victim in a way before revealing who they are? Or what do you say to a child to help prevent this?
And you say older men, too. It's not always older men. I mean, I've seen it with the age gap is you know, 4 or 5 years between victim and trafficker.
In fact, the one who was convicted in January.
Yes, ma'am.
He was 20 years old. You can call me Rachel. Thank you for that. He was 20 years old. Is that right? I might be conflating
that
him with
the
one. That
one is September.
Okay.
The one in January was a little bit older, but at the time when everything was going on, he was still no more than, you know, 4 or 5 years age difference.
Under
21 victims.
Years old.
Yes.
So not even legally able to drink.
No, ma'am.
And he's pimping. Jessica Green.
Well, and I think it's important to note that not only do we need to be having discussions with young girls about what healthy relationships look like, but we also need to be having discussions with young men about what healthy relationships look like and addressing, you know, we are bombarded with images every single day that teach us to objectify other people, and that can be really harmful, and it creates this attitude where you can view someone as less than a person, and that's the first step towards committing an act of violence against someone.
Viewing someone as an object.
Right.
And actually, since you bring this up, there was a video blog in which actor and comedian Russell Brand talked about this. And he talked about it through the lens of softcore pornography. He talked about some of the documented harmful effects of this, and he also talks about how it actually affects him. So let's listen.
And one of the reasons that I've sensed that pornography isn't good for me as an individual is because of this the kind of conclusions reached by Gary R. Brooks, who's observed the consumption of softcore pornography like Playboy. He talked about the five main symptoms of looking at softcore porn. But softcore porn really is everywhere. 50 Shades of Grey is softcore porn. TV adverts, billboards are full of softcore porn. And here are some of the effects of this, the symbolism of this culture. Voyeurism, an obsession with looking at women rather than interacting with them. I do that sometimes. I just think, that woman looks beautiful. I don't think, oh, I hope she gets on well with her dad. I hope she doesn't have diabetes. What's she like as a soul, as another person here in infinite space? I just think, well, she looks nice. Objectification, an attitude in which women are objects, right, by size, shape, harmony of body parts. Guilty of that all of the time because, you know, I've been acculturated and trained to. This is something that I work on, like, no, come on, see everybody as equal human beings. But once that biological drive to procreate is connected with a culture of objectification, that's a very hard equation to break.
Russell Brand, actor and comedian, in one of his video blogs about the effect of softcore porn. Jessica Green, what's your reaction to that?
Well, I think that due to technology being so vast and everywhere the way that it is, it's a really wonderful thing in a lot of ways, but it also can be really harmful because not only softcore porn, but also hardcore porn is a very easily accessible, and boys are accessing these sorts of images at younger and younger ages. And what used to be shocking 20 years ago is now so commonplace. And so there's little to no mediation, little to no conversation about these images that they're seeing and what that means and how that's not really an accurate depiction of what actual relationships are like. And so people get the wrong messages from earlier and earlier ages, and it's really hard to combat that.
We have a question from a listener who wants to remain anonymous. The question, the focus is often on survivors, but what about the people who purchase these women and children? What is being done to educate this population, particularly young men, particularly servicemen?
The Safe Harbor Act in October 2013, you know, a lot of things changed with that to include punishments for the traffickers and for the consumers, the Johns. All the punishments have stiffened. Don't quote me exactly on it. I'm not exactly sure, but I know for a fact that they are now much more harsh than they were before.
The punishments for the people who are purchasing these services.
Yes, ma'am.
Jessica Green.
Well, in regards to young men, I can definitely give a wonderful shout out to our Rape Prevention Education Department because they are in our schools, in our community, talking with young women and men about primary prevention of sexual violence, which includes sex trafficking. So they're addressing things that lead to the objectification of other people, that lead to perpetrating behaviors such as believing in rigid gender stereotypes, the oppression of other human beings. All of these things are addressed, and the results that they're getting are really wonderful. We actually had to go from working with eighth graders because we were getting awesome results, but they were telling us by the time in eighth grade, we're already experiencing sexual harassment in the hallway, unwanted touching, sexually suggestive comments. So this is really wonderful and great and educative, but it is too late. So now we've kind of shifted and we're going with younger children to try and prevent this from ever happening.
That's got to be a little shocking for a parent to think that their sixth grader needs education about things like inappropriate touching or sexual violence in a relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it can be very surprising, but if you just watch any television show that's aimed towards teenagers. I have young cousins and they'll mention shows, and so I'll watch them to kind of see what it is that they're watching. And there's one that a predominant relationship is actually between a student and a teacher. And we're rooting for this couple because that's how they're portraying it, is that it's romantic. And in my mind, I'm like, I cannot believe that they are seeing this and that they're being told that this is what romance is supposed to be because it's illegal and highly, highly inappropriate.
Detective Campbell, what should a parent do if they suspect that their child might be communicating online with a sexual predator?
Really, parents have got to stay on top of what their kids are doing as far as, you know, with the cell phones and iPods and iPads and computers and all that. A lot of parents, especially when I was a juvenile detective, they would ask, what can I do? Give your kids a flip phone that doesn't take pictures, that all it does is make phone calls. And, they don't need to have that access in the palm of their hand. to be able to communicate with people like that. That's really the biggest thing. I think that's the root of a lot of problems right now, is the amount of access that these kids have to the outside world.
And so certainly when that child goes home, they're inevitably going to get on social media on the computer at home. Is there anything that parents can do at home? Because certainly a lot of this happens under the same roof.
Right. I mean, just monitor it or prevent it, you know, make them go outside, make them be kids outside and be involved in things. The more they sit there and are not doing that, then the more susceptible they are to this.
Jessica Green from the Rape Crisis Center.
Well, I think it's also important to encourage parents to have conversations with kids about these sorts of things. I think we're so terrified to engage in conversations about things like healthy sexuality because all we hear is sex, and that we think that then we're going to be giving kids ideas. But if we are engaging in a dialogue saying, I want to talk to you about these things, and you may be seeing these images, you may be getting these messages, and I want to discuss this with you, then you're becoming an askable parent, which means that if something does happen, if you do get a message where there's something really inappropriate, that child feels like they can come and they can talk to you. Because if you don't talk about healthy sexuality, then that's giving the message of this is something that we are not okay talking about, and that can be really harmful.
So a parent could hear this and agree with you in theory,
right,
about the advantages of talking with your child. But when it comes to the practical world, let's say this parent's head explodes. This parent has no skills for doing that. Is there anything the parent can do to find some guidance?
Well, there's lots of resources out there. If you contact us at the Rape Crisis Center, we would be happy to point you in the right direction, because this is a really important discussion to have, and it is a huge, huge preventative factor for sexual violence or sex trafficking.
The media has given a lot of attention to human trafficking and sex trafficking in the last few years. It's a topic that fascinates the public. Is there an upside to that? Are there things that the public can be looking for? What do you want to leave people with about signs to look for, potential red flags, ways that they can actually contribute to squashing this in this community? Detective Campbell.
I think the media has raised a lot of awareness, as well as local nonprofits here that are doing a lot of outreach. One in particular, A Safe Place, they do outreach in churches and a lot of community events. So a lot of people now are seeing what's going on. And there's actually a hotline number where if you see something that you can report it. If you want, I can give that to you now.
Please.
It's 855-723-7529. And if you see something, just like the officer that makes a traffic stop that thinks something's not quite right. If you think something's not quite right, then say something and, you know, call it in, and then we'll look into it. I mean, I get feedback directly from that hotline, and, you know, the conviction that we got in September of last year was a result of that number.
Jessica Green, final thoughts. What can people do?
Well, I think that all the awareness and attention that it's getting is really wonderful, because we are recognizing that it's not people being held in chains and ropes. We're seeing less and less pictures that are kind of depicting that, because that's not a realistic view of what we're seeing. You know, these people are able to go out and to walk and talk and do all of those things without chains or a rope. However, it's the psychological hold, and I think that us having understanding of that's really important.
That's this edition of Coastline. I'd like to thank our guests, Detective Will Campbell of the New Hanover County Sheriff's Office and Jessica Green of Coastal Horizons Rape Crisis Center. Thanks also to you, our listeners, those of you who called in and emailed. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Join us for the next Coastline when we explore where we are in North Carolina with four terminal groin projects. That's next Wednesday at noon here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.